Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, beloved character actor Judge Reinhold discusses his new film, Swing Vote, and the possibility of a fourth Beverly Hills Cop. It's all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Everybody, this is Movie Geeks United, a very special episode of Movie Geeks United. I am your host. My name is Jamie, and Jerry and Chris, our fellow movie geeks, are off this evening. We have a very special, like I mentioned, show for you this evening, a special pre-recorded interview with a terrific character actor that we all know and love, Judge Reinhold. We had the pleasure of speaking with him several weeks ago. And he is just a terrific conversationalist, just a tremendous generosity of spirit and a terrific talent. His new film comes out Friday, August 1st. It's called Swing Vote. Co-stars Kevin Costner, Kelsey Grammer, Nathan Lane, Dennis Hopper. Great cast in that film. And I also asked him about the rumors of a possible fourth Beverly Hills Cop film, and he had quite a lot to say on that matter. So this is a highly enjoyable conversation. We'll get it started right now. I hope you guys like the interview. Thanks for tuning in. Our next guest has given us a tremendous amount of joy and entertainment over a career that spans nearly 30 years. He's delivered unforgettable performances in a breathtaking roster of timeless films like Stripes, Gremlins, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Ruthless People, Into the West, and both the Santa Claus and Beverly Hills Cop trilogies. He was nominated for an Emmy for his guest role in the hit comedy Seinfeld, and his next film finds him in the company of Kevin Costner, Dennis Hopper, and Kelsey Grammer as he co-stars in the political comedy Swing Vote, opening August 1st. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome this fantastic actor to Movie Geeks United, Mr. Judge Reinhold. Mr. Reinhold,
wow.
Hello.
Thank you.
First sentence, it sounded pretty good.
Oh no, it was all good. No. It's true. I don't. They say age is mind over matter. If you don't mind, it don't matter. You know.
Right.
And so I'm good. It is a little disconcerting when people say I grew up with your movies because I guess I was kind of. It's not like I was thinking like Jim Morrison. I'll never make it to 30, but. It's just an odd thing to suddenly, especially if, you know, with the consideration of Obama possibly being president, the idea of a president actually younger than you, that's frightening. You know, I don't know if I can vote for the guy just for that. You know,
start feeling your age, yeah.
Oh, man, that's freaky. Yeah,
but you do have these credits to your name that appeal
yeah.
to all different generations, from Fast Times to the Beethoven and Santa Claus movies, and of course Beverly Hills
yeah.
Cop. Do you find that new generations are discovering these films?
I'm actually getting work from some of these young directors that grew up with these movies. So it's professionally, it's pretty cool. There's a little cachet involved with. Then grown up watching Beverly Hills Cop and Fast Times and stuff. As a matter of fact, the director, Joshua Michael Stern, who co-wrote and directed the Swing Vote that I'm doing with Kevin Costner, was one of those people who said, oh, I can't read Judge Reinhold, just give him the role. So that was sweet.
That's fantastic. Now take me back to the beginning. I want to know who your influences
yeah.
were when you wanted to become an actor.
Okay. The first time I really realized actor was. I guess I was watching Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated by his Westerns and just his whole persona.
Yeah.
And then I remember skipping school and sneaking into Catch 22 at the age of 12 years old, and that totally blew my mind. It just blew my mind. And Alan Arkin became my acting mentor from afar. And as great fortune would have it, he ended up oddly on the set of Santa Claus 3, and we became friends. We both live in Santa Fe, and the rest is history. It took me days to call him up. I'd get the nerve to call him up on the phone, and I finally did, and I left a message, a very awkward message, and then I went into town and came back, and there the light was blinking. I thought, oh, it's Arkin, oh my God. And he says, Judge, oh wow, what a pleasure to hear from you. People in our business don't do that. Let's have lunch, take a walk, shoot coyotes, whatever it is you want to do, I would be happy to do. And so, so it's so exciting to be personal friends with.
That's fantastic.
He was really my hero,
Oh, yeah. So. Oh, yeah. And what a hero to have. I mean, he's phenomenal. Phenomenal. Did you start in theater? You did something with Burt Reynolds at his theater company, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. But it's I was a sophomore in high school, got on the stage, and it felt like home. I just felt completely comfortable up there, and my life suddenly became very simple and uncomplicated. And so I was a goner from then on. I didn't think about making a living or anything. I just had to be on the stage and telling a story.
This is what I'm curious about, because obviously I want to ask you about how the industry, the business, has changed for you in the past 30 years. But in terms of your need to act, what it fulfills in you, what is that, and has that changed over the course of your career?
That's a good question. It used to be just the thrill of being an actor and getting a laugh, and it's luckily evolved and refined into the desire to tell a good story. And so it's evolved into a producing a need to tell some stories that reflect things that I just the way I see the world, and a need to try to do things well after almost 30 years of watching people make unnecessary and careless mistakes. I'm certainly going to make my own mistakes, but I'd rather make my own than just watch the same ones be made over and over again. So to answer your question, it went from just kind of wanting to get the attention to really wanting to turn out some great stories,
Yeah, and I want to talk to you a little later about your producing work, because I think it's very important when I've read what you have to say about some of these projects. I did read a quote from you. And it speaks to what you've just said, I think. You said, I want to do things of significance, things that will inspire people to know how good life can be. It's very easy to make a movie that confirms the worst in us. How does Swing Vote fit that bill for you?
Ah, that's a great segue, because it's the story of the whole country being deadlocked. The presidential election comes down to one man's vote. And Kevin plays just a barely functioning alcoholic and a father who is really taken care of by his 11-year-old daughter. And he gets to work. She makes sure she gets him to work. It's in a little town that the main industry is boxing eggs. And I play his friend Walter, complete with mullet and handlebar mustache. Anyway, he's got to get his act together to figure out who's going to be president. And, of course, the whole world descends on the little town of Texaco, New Mexico, which actually exists. We just had to move it to Albuquerque for logistical sake. It's really close to the border of Mexico and New Mexico. The story is very Capra-esque. Yes. Extremely Capra-esque. I feel like I have the Ward Bond role, you know.
Yeah.
It's the most Capra-esque movie I've come across, really. And to the point where I thought, we all kind of looked at each other and thought, this is the closest we're going to get to work with Frank Capra, because the story is something that he could so easily have done. Mm. And because it's about one guy in the whole world, with the whole, literally the whole world on his shoulders. And per your question, when I first read the script, I thought, oh, this is going to end up with this kind of nihilistic look at how messed up everything is, and how corrupt politics has become, and how lost we all are. But surprisingly, with kind of a Capra-esque hopefulness, it ends with everybody having a crisis of conscience. Mm. And they look at themselves and realize that it's like Obama says, you know, what does Obama say? The future is you or something, or we're the change that we're looking for. And so actually it is kind of, not to get political, but it is kind of like that. Everybody looks at themselves except for the two handlers of the two, Kelsey Grammer plays the Republican president, flies in on Air Force One and gets Richard Petty to pick Kevin up from his trailer to drive him to Air Force One to try to get him on the Republican side. And Dennis Hopper gets Willie Nelson to sing for Kevin to get him over on the Democratic side. Everybody ends up looking at themselves except for the handlers, the Karl Rove character, the Machiavellian characters. In this case, it's played by Stanley Tucci, who is such a brilliant actor. And Nathan Lane plays the handler on the Democratic side. Not Carvel. It's not really Carvel. I don't know who really I don't know who the template is for that, but those guys are the nefarious ones. If there are villains, it's the spinners, because even the candidates take a hard look at themselves. So that's a really long-winded answer, but it does have. Sorry, but it's rare. One thing that really made me fall in love with the script was it ends positively. It ends with hope, but in a practical way, not in a Hollywood, you know, perfunctory way. Well, we'll just throw in this little fairy tale hopefulness. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, so it couldn't be more timely, obviously. We're talking about the presidential election process, and that seems like such a subject matter that's ripe for satire. Is it almost difficult to satirize because we see it? I mean, it's obvious how extreme the process is and how far people go in this process. And
yeah, that's what's so great is that it is grounded in reality, but it's hysterically funny. When you crack the crew up, you know you got something. You know, that's been my experience. When the crew's laughing, then you know you got something good, because they don't have to laugh. You know?
Right.
So I think it's satire at its best, really, because it's not too far-fetched. It doesn't get too broad, and it's based in very significant, timely the themes. You know?
Yeah. What do you hope that people take away from it?
Personal responsibility and their need to vote.
Mm.
Kevin's character represents American lethargy, American indulgence, and hey, I love my country. I don't mean to sound like, you know, one of those people. We just have to grow up a little bit, you know, and get involved in our, gosh, the least we can do is vote or don't complain, you know?
Right.
So it's about personal responsibility. It's on every level. That's what I like about it. The president of the United States has to look and see, hey, wait a minute, this guy's spinning me out of control. All the things that I once believed in, I'm compromising for one man's vote.
Right. Right.
And Dennis Hopper, the Democratic candidate on the other side, is faced with that too. Everybody has a crisis of conscience, and everybody takes a closer look at the choices that they've been making and how responsible they are. We're all responsible. Everybody's. Then I'll shut up about this. But
this is fantastic. I think this is terrific.
Everybody's really tied to the choices we make. Anybody who tells you that's not true is just they're not looking squarely at their life.
Yeah.
Everybody is tied to the decisions that we make, positive or negative. They're going to affect people around you,
yeah.
And that's really the message. You know, how much responsibility we take and how involved we get in what's going on it's going to determine, if not on a grand scale, then certainly our sphere of influence and our own communities.
Yeah.
So his character goes from lethargy, apathy, the drunkenness is supposed to represent just total indulgence, pulling himself up and saying, "Wow, I better try to do the right thing."
Yeah. I think it's an important message to project out there, you know. But obviously, first and foremost, this is a comedy.
That's great. You're right on target because you can. What was it I saw recently? It was so. It was so preachy.
Yeah.
And proselytizing, and then I thought about our movie, and I thought the reason I love our movie is because it doesn't proselytize, but it teaches on a level that is purely entertaining, and that it's harder work to do that, but that's what great satire is. It's got to be entertaining.
Yeah, absolutely. And tell me about your director. You mentioned him earlier. For this
Joshua
film.
Michael Stern, yeah, he's an exciting writer director, and Kevin gave him a shot. And,
I asked because this is a man that he's already lined up his next project, and it's King Lear with Anthony Hopkins. So he seems very ambitious, this filmmaker.
That's what he's doing, King Lear?
Yes, he's doing Lear with Hopkins is what I've
read
in the trades, yeah.
Wow, good for him. I'm surprised, too. That's great.
Is there a particular joy in doing comedy for you?
Yeah, it brings people together. Some of my greatest moments of my life have been standing in the back of a theater, a crowded theater, and hearing people collectively laugh. And I remember in the early 90s walking down a street in New York all self-pitying and indulgent about why people didn't take me more seriously. I wanted to be a serious New York theatrical actor, and I wasn't getting anywhere. And I was all filled with myself and this lady walked up to me and she said, "I just want to thank you because my mother has been struggling with terminal cancer for 10 months and last night I took her to Ruthless People and it was the first time in 10 months I'd seen her laugh and I just want to thank you for that." And
yeah.
Man, I got about 2 blocks and then you know I just started crying, you know.
Yeah, that puts it all in perspective.
Seminal, yeah, you don't realize. That goes back to my little theme that we don't realize the choices we make, how they affect other people. It really is a chain reaction. We don't realize, you know.
That's why, I wanted to open up the introduction by saying that, I mean, you have given us a tremendous amount of joy and delight over the course of your career. Yeah, and just these timeless movies, and Ruthless People is actually, it's at the top of my list, too. It slays me.
Yeah, it works. I'm proud of that movie. I know it was a while ago, but as far as farce goes, it really works. And, that script was so tight, it was the only time I really felt that confident when I read Dale Lawner's original script, which incidentally was based on The Ransom of Red Chief, an O. Henry short story about an Indian chief whose wife is kidnapped and he doesn't want her back. So Dale very, very adroitly adapted that story. And I read the script and said, you know what, we'd have to work so hard to mess this up. It was so tight. Also, any director could have directed. That one was kind of, very few movies are director-proof. If the Coen brothers had done that movie, it would have been completely different but just as successful. If, Woody Allen would have done that movie or gosh, you know, many other people, it would have been just as successful. It'd be fun to see the movie remade. I'd like to see it done a little less broad, with a little more tension. But that's not to say I don't enjoy it.
You know, that's interesting that you brought that up. That it's director proof because one of my questions to you concerning the Beverly Hills Cop trilogy that you've been involved in. You had a situation where you had three films, three directors. Did that make each experience different in your mind?
Oh yeah, there's so much more of a director's personality inherent in a movie than they even want you to know.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to me. Marty Brest loves people. He's fascinated by people, and so his rendering, his Beverly Hills Cop 1 is filled with colorful characters. And the quirks and idiosyncrasies of characters. That's basically why I have a career, really. And I was shocked that he left as much of my stuff in. That's also evident in Midnight Run. He just loves characters. And then Tony Scott is, he's all about the fast motorcycles and incredible effects. But he's also very soulful too. He's like a little kid, you know. I think he's evolved as a filmmaker too since I've worked with him. But he was all about things that go fast and big-breasted women, and so that movie had that kind of energy about it, that testosterone. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then John Landis brought a frivolity to it, which it was Sherry Lansing and Eddie's choice. I think John is an amazing director. Let me say this about the third one. The chop shop scene, the first sequence in that movie was so hot. And that's what the whole movie needed to be. I was so excited when I saw that. And then it kind of went into this kind of farcical thing. And if there was anything we had already learned in the first two is the mixture of suspense and tension where you have to create real stakes. There's real danger. People can really mess you up. The villains are very, very bad. Marty did it beautifully in that shot in the hallway. It goes to a long shot and you see Petey, James Russo being shot in the back of the head by Jonathan Banks. And these guys don't play. And that fuels the movie, and the comedy is a release from the tension. But in order to get that, you got to get that tension. And I think we let that go.
It cries out to be more of an adult film, Beverly Hills Cop, I think.
I know. We were surprised that John and Eddie were working together. On one hand, certainly I know that Eddie has great respect for John. He certainly owes a lot of his career to him, I think. And likewise, you know, vice versa. Those early movies, Trading Places, that's how Eddie really, man, you know, he was always funny, but he got his acting chops in his movies. It didn't match up sensibility-wise. It was also the first time we worked with that Don and Jerry, and that was sad. That was sad for everybody.
Is there a particular joy in doing? Yeah, you could feel their contribution missing.
Still alive. Don was still alive, but Jerry and the guys, really the guys that were running Paramount at the time, after Days of Thunder. rather than just chastise them and punish them some way, they fired them. And they went over to Disney, and I watched our franchise, one of Paramount's most successful franchises, passed around to a bunch of Hollywood characters. It was pretty painful to see it passed around like that. And you know,
well, here comes the question that you're probably asked 50 times a day. the talk of a fourth film, is that something that excites you, that notion?
Well, Brett Ratner, I like very much. We've met several times. He says that he appreciates my work. I don't know Lorenzo di Bonaventura. I don't know if Eddie wants to completely scrap everything and start a new franchise and be more like Bruce Willis in the Die Hard movies. That's one rumor. I'm notoriously the last person they come to so they can say they're out. You know, we don't have any money left, and, you know, we're sorry we don't have any time. so that's been the strategy. I don't know what's going to happen, but that's not unusual for me not to know.
Right.
I would love to see Eddie be, especially now after Dreamgirls, he could be so exciting and dangerous, sexy, you know. And I'd love to see Rosewood on the bomb squad. It was such a mistake to have Rosewood climbing this bureaucratic ladder. Man, give the guy some heavy explosives. Let him blow up the wrong house, you know, the wrong building. It's dying to be done. I was so disappointed when they gave me that bureaucratic dead-end job, you know.
Right.
And
right.
So to answer your question, I would be dying to put it right. I'll be sad if the reason why Eddie comes back. Historically, Eddie has to come back to Beverly Hills to avenge somebody's death, and I hope it's not Billy that gets shot in the head. You know, I really hope that's not the case. I don't know that I would do that. I don't want to kill Billy off.
There's such a special chemistry between the two of you, though, and it really makes those films sing for me. So I think you're an invaluable contribution to those films. I can't imagine it without you.
Oh, man, I appreciate that. Anybody listening, write Paramount, because I'd love to be in the movie. I mean, it's not just – I want to put it right. I want to do it for Don Simpson. I want to do it for the right reasons. Hey, I want to make money, you know, but I also – I just want to put – I don't want to end like that, you know?
Right, right.
I really don't. I want to bring it back, and the action comedy is – It's a great genre when it's done right. When the mixture of true danger and true high stakes and comedy it's beautiful. You know, I loved it. I loved doing it, and I think we really achieved it in the first two.
Yeah.
I remember when the day Brigitte Nielsen walked on our set, I thought, did she walk off the James Bond set into our? It was like she walked into our franchise from another one. I thought, this I don't get, but anyway, I'd love Lorenzo di Bonaventura is a very smart guy. He's a dark, edgy filmmaker, and I think that's what it needs. But obviously, I'd like to be in it. But I want to blow some crap up, man.
It's about time.
I want to be in the bomb. They gotta put me in the bomb squad. And I had this idea where maybe what brings them, instead of having me shot, why don't I get in over my head undercover where I've learned something that's true, but I'm way over my head with these guys, whoever they are, whether it's a terrorist plot or whatever, and I disappear. And he's got to come get me, and he takes care of business, you know.
I think you need to write your own draft, my friend. I think you've got...
I got 10 years of ideas that it's totally indiscreet talking about it on the air, but I don't know. You know, I hope I get the chance to give some ideas, because I've thought about it more than probably anybody.
Yeah,
not the movie, but in terms of what Billy would do.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I'd love to see him on on one of those Segway bikes, too. What if he's a Segway bike cop? These guys kill me. I saw recently on the street, I saw a Segway cop was leading a suspect to the station, but he was riding behind him, and he was herding the guy to the station. So the suspect was walking in front of the Segway in such a humiliating way. It was so humiliating. He was handcuffed, and he was walking in front of the Segway. And anyway, those guys kill me. That would be another way to go.
We would love to see that. Now, speaking of your ideas for Beverly Hills Cop, you've kind of broadened your scope from actor to producer and writer for your own company. I think you share it with your wife.
Yeah. Yes. That's true. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No. I just want to tell me if I have this correct. You want to produce films with Christian based films?
Oh no. That's blah. It's weird. Blogging.
Okay, I read somewhere that was it.
One of the stories is a true story. The guy, he's a layman. He's not a priest, but I guess it's because of that connection that people are saying that, but it's really not accurate.
Okay.
I just came across in Time magazine. I was sitting in a rusty trailer in New Zealand on a B movie, happy to be in New Zealand, but wondering really where my career was headed. I wasn't making a contribution in any way. I was just making a living, which I'm very grateful for. But you know, I didn't get into it to make a living. I got into it to tell stories. So I'm reading this Time magazine article about this guy in Chicago in 1983. This goofy white guy who walked into the Chicago projects, where at that time it was Beirut, Lebanon, and Cabrini Green, Chicago, were the two most dangerous places on earth. The year before, like 170 kids had been brutally killed by snipers, mostly by gang warfare. This guy walks into the middle of gang gunfire 54 times and stands there. He stands there like the guy in Tiananmen Square.
Hmm.
He has this like epiphany, and it's not a proselytizing movie. It has no agenda. It has no spiritual agenda. It's just, this is the story of what happened. This guy, something told him that if he did what he was hearing, that he'd be safe. So the approach is hypothetical. The approach is really to tell the story just for how it happened. People carry away their own, variety of perspectives. But I'm fascinated by this idea of the miraculous penetrating our everyday reality. And if you call that religious or Christian, whatever.
I guess it was a particular slant of the article I read. I'm sorry I took it verbatim, but
okay. It's just that I don't like being put in a box. No, but
right.
Why do we put each other? I hear I go proselytizing, why are we so quick? It's to put each other in boxes just because everything is so quick around us. We have to categorize everything.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, what does that make me? If I'm a Christian and then suddenly I'm a right-wing zealot, military, industrial complex, wacko, I mean, there's all these equations.
Yeah.
It
is very divisive. I mean, it's a way to divide you and put you in your place. I mean,
I think it's the way that the political system, I think that divisiveness was created for a political purpose, and it worked very effectively, unfortunately. And I hope we're coming out of that era now. And I don't mind saying I think Karl Rove is responsible for that divisiveness, and it worked. He was brilliant at it.
Yeah.
But I don't consider him a great patriot.
Right. Well, right. But I think if I understand correctly, in terms of your vision for the movies you'd like to produce and write and possibly act in for your company, you want to make films that mean something, that have
I didn't decide now I'm going to produce. I was in, like I said, a rusty trailer in New Zealand and read this story that made me weep with how beautiful it was. because the guy stood there with almost total strangers and offered his life to these kids.
Yeah.
Stood there in the middle of gunfire and basically said, even though you don't think your life is worth living, I love you enough to sacrifice my life for you.
Yeah.
That's a very, very powerful thing to say. And what happened was, without any talk, without any proselytizing, without any preaching, it was just pure, that was it. It was like, I'm willing to lay down my life for you. And they're like, man, this guy's crazy, man. And then, slowly by slowly, he'd show up in the hospital room, and one of them was shot. They'd come out of anesthesia. There was Bill. You know, he'd be sitting there when the family left. Well, he'd take them to court. He'd take them to jail. He'd go visit them in jail. And they became a community. They became a community, and they gave him the gift of community. He was an outsider in his own world, graduated Notre Dame, but a real loner and an eccentric guy. And so it's not a story of a white guy walking in and, you know, saving this community. It's not that at all. It's the story of an incredibly powerful domino effect, a chain reaction that was started by one man standing still in the middle of gunfire. And that's what the story is. It's a chain reaction. And if they want to call it religious or, you know, whatever.
No, I think it speaks to what's best of us. And I am always looking for movies that do that. I mean, it seems to be more and more of a cynical kind of landscape, you know, all over. So your co-star from years back, Sean Penn, I remember him saying that movies are too powerful a medium to take lightly. You know, you have to express something. Yeah. And so I'm
with you. It's true. You're absolutely. It's just that you're so right. If filmmakers took a real hard look at how powerful the medium is, then they'd have to take responsibility for their own work, and they don't want to do that.
Right.
I read an article recently in Psychology Today that we are the most open when we're watching a movie that we like.
Mm-hmm.
We're even more vulnerable than when we're having sex. It's the most unguarded time in our life. And when you turn around in an audience and you see, like, gang members, like, looking like little boys watching a movie, you know how powerful that is.
Yeah,
and to use that in a destructive way is, it's wrong, you know, because it really is a powerful thing. Storytelling, man. Wow.
Well, Mr. Reinhold, I really appreciate you spending time with us today, and if our show is about anything, it's about passion for filmmaking and what it's capable of, and I just hear it in your voice. It's infectious, and thank you so much for that, and thank you so much for so many years of great entertainment, and I can't wait to see what you got going on in the future.
Oh, thanks. Let me tell you, it's not like a comedian that wants to be taken seriously. I got some very funny movies up my sleeve, too, you know? So hopefully I'll get a chance to make them. And I sure appreciate it's fun to talk about. And I hope I didn't get on a too big of a grandstand.
You're one of the best interviews I've ever had. It's been I've had such a good time.
Man, I have too. I think we're on the same page.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Please come back anytime in the future. We'd love to welcome you back.
Absolutely. Just give me a call.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Reinhold.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Judge Reinhold, just a delightful, delightful talent. Hope you enjoyed the show. Tune in again. We'll be back on Sunday, where we will welcome author Jeremy Vineyard, and we'll discuss his new book, Setting Up the Shots. The movie geeks will discuss their favorite shots and sequences from films, and we'll also welcome Randall Miller, the director of a new film called Bottle Shock. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.